This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today, we'll learn about one of the most destructive fires in Milwaukee's history and how it reshaped the city. We'll start with this. Preparing your garden for the growing season is often a daunting task, but when that garden is more than 2 acres and home to dozens of different plots, well, that's a task for a whole team. Alice's Garden Urban Farm on Milwaukee's north side is a place where families and organizations rent out plots of land where they tend to a wide variety of plants. The garden is representative of a vast swath of cultures and culinary traditions. This past Tuesday on Earth Day, people gathered to help tend and clean the farm in preparation for the coming year. Lake Effect's Joy Powers met up with Alice's Garden Executive Director Venus Williams to wander the garden ahead of the event, along with the group's new assistant farm manager, Abdul Qadir Hassan.
It's always an interesting weather day on Earth Day. Sometimes we get all four seasons and the earth is showing off. So I think we'll get two today, but we're always excited to invite the community in here at Alice's Garden Urban Farm, not just to help us get ready for the growing season, but to invite people in who may never otherwise touch the soil or understand the transitioning of plants, the perennials. As we are here today, we will be cutting back this incredible sage bush that we could have cut back at the end of the season, but we did not get to. But we'll also use it as an offering. We will put it in our fire pit, and we will do a blessing and a burnt offering as we begin the official start of the season here at Alice's Garden Urban Farm.
A kind of an outdoor saging of sorts.
Without a doubt, which is something that I do every week on my block. I walk my whole block every week and sage my block as well. They don't know they have that protection, but they do every week. So as people come in today, we'll be getting rid of the dead branches and twigs and inviting new life. And that's what spring is about. It's also a metaphor for our lives this time of year. We always talk about the spring cleaning of our homes. Well, we do spiritual spring cleaning as well. But today at Alice's Garden Urban Farm on this Earth Day, we will do a physical spring cleaning for the soil, for the perennials, for the annuals that we will soon plant here at Alice's.
As I'm looking around, it seems like both that there is so much to do, but also like a lot of opportunity.
Without a doubt. I was saying to someone earlier, this time of year, I see so much work. But it's actually a welcome sign. It's a welcome sign to connect with soil and beneficial insects. It's a welcome sign to prepare this land, this piece of earth, for the pollinators, for the birds who will be nourished because of all the things that we grow here, for even the rabbits who we plant enough for them and us. So we are siblings in creation, and Earth Day always reminds me of how connected I am, but also of my responsibility to steward the earth. People often say, we need to save the earth. We can't save the earth. It's our egos, our human egos, thinking that we can save the earth. We can't save the earth, but we can do better as caretakers of the earth.
Yeah. Now, as you're thinking about Earth Day and Earth Week and the celebrations that many people are having, what does that mean for you as somebody who is so connected to the earth?
For me personally, when the growing season begins, I can't help but think of my ancestors. You know, I'm always going to discuss the ancestors. I can't help but think of my great-grandparents, who I knew personally, who cultivated land and food, and who were the first farmers in my life. I can't help but think of both of my grandmothers, maternal and paternal, who taught me how to grow tomatoes and radishes. I will plant my radishes this week in honor of my grandmother, Helen. A lot of people don't like radishes. I plant them solely to remember my grandmother, Helen, and it's a 30-day or 28-day crop, and I will have them in salads for a good week or so.
What do you think your ancestors, your grandmothers and your great-grandparents would think of the garden on this day?
Oh, well, my paternal grandmother, Ora Ding, did get to see this, and she loved it. It reminded her of home. It reminded her, as she said, of Daddy. But I think one of the things that really makes all of our ancestors proud is when we invite people, young folks like Abdul, to come in and to learn how to cultivate food. Prior to last year, Abdul was not a farmer. He literally learned from the very beginning, and now he embraces it fully and is our assistant farm manager. For me, that's the bigger picture of everything that we are called to do as we are called to be responsible for the earth. It's not just about us right now in the moment. It's also about passing everything we know on to the next generation. If it dies with us, what's the point?
Abdul, what are you looking forward to today?
I'm looking forward to learn more about what the earth can give to us. When I came here, I knew not much of anything. And so as time passed, I learned how much more the earth can give to me as I catered to it. The vegetables, the fruits, anything you put into the soil, it gives back.
As you're looking at this both beautiful garden, but also a lot of work, a lot of work that has to be done, what are you seeing?
I see a chance for growth. I see a chance to learn, a chance to get closer together, a chance to form more bonds, opportunity. I see opportunity.
And he's also, I'm sure, very eager to have all these volunteers in here today, because then that means it's less work on the front end for all of us. And even though it may rain today, this garden will be filled with joy, intergenerational joy. And that's one of the things I really love about Earth Day. Even when it falls on a weekday, we will have families, we will have groups from businesses who will come out together, who have signed up to come out. We'll have a couple of school groups who will be out here today. So it also, Earth Day provides the opportunity to bridge all sorts of things that may keep us apart normally in Milwaukee. There are people who will meet on this day who will not just celebrate the earth, but celebrate new beginnings of friendships and acquaintances.
Abdul Qadir Hassan is the assistant farm manager at Alice's Garden. Venus Williams is the executive director of Alice's Garden and the Fondi Food Center. She regularly joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers for a series we call Dig In, and you can find our previous conversations with her at WUWM.com. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen to us on demand. Later in the show, we'll bring our latest group chat about the Milwaukee Film Festival kicking off today. But first, in Bubbler Talk, we'll explore one of the most devastating fires in Milwaukee's history that reshaped the city. That's coming up on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we're wrapping up our latest season of Bubbler Talk, and we're closing out the season with a special, extended Bubbler Talk about a devastating fire that reshaped the city of Milwaukee. It's told by former firefighter and now WUWM reporter Jimmy Gutierrez.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
Renee? Hey! I figured if I had my gear on, it'd make me easy to spot.
I'm WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez, And this week's Bubbler Talk is a trip down memory lane.
This has been a lot of fun for me.
Because you're a fireman.
I was, yes.
I only like trolled you a little bit on the...
I mean, that's what the Google's for.
That's right.
I met up with Renee Kubisch after she asked a question I've often wondered myself.
Actually, during the recent California fires, it made me start to wonder if and how fires shaped Milwaukee development and community.
Now, we know Chicago is home of the Great Fire, and that was 1871, the same year as the most devastating fire in Wisconsin history, the Peshtigo Fire. That was the deadliest forest fire in all of U.S. history. But what about Milwaukee? We're in the Third Ward because this neighborhood holds many past lives, including a fire that wiped out just about everything we know today is the Third Ward. Like, gone. 20 square blocks turned into a wasteland. The Third Ward Fire of 1892.
Historic places. Milwaukee Fire Department Engine Company number 10. Architect unknown. And then there's a beautiful statue of a fireman and his dog. Oh, and now it is at the Ascension Medical Group. It's a medical clinic.
Very different than what it once was.
Very different.
This is the first and only firehouse that had ever burned down in Milwaukee. And as you remember,
there have been deadlier fires in Milwaukee, and fires that have been deadlier for firefighters, but none that have shaped the city as much, or cost as much, or displaced as many people. To learn more about what happened Friday night, October 28th, 1892, I reached out to one of my old bosses, Secretary for the Milwaukee Fire Historical Society and Milwaukee Fire Department Battalion Chief, Dan Rohde.
We know today what we call the term wind-driven fires.
Chief Rohde says that night, besides being cool and dry, was incredibly windy. The local paper reported gale-force winds around 50 miles per hour. Perfect conditions for Milwaukee's most destructive fire.
5:43 that night, box 28 came in, basically on water and what is currently Buffalo Street. It was a three-story building. It was called the Union Oil and Paint Company, and they had a significant fire in there already.
At the time, people are coming home from work, and firefighters, some tending to other fires, weren't able to get there for 15 minutes.
And you can imagine with oils and paints, they're very flammable materials.
Multiple engines show up fighting the fire from the east. From the west, the department's fire boat, the Cataract, is dousing the building. After an hour and the death of one firefighter, the fire is extinguished. At least, that's what the men thought.
So no sooner were they done with the Union Oil and Paint Factory than the furniture factory catches on fire.
The theory is that the wind pushed hot embers from that first fire over a block away.
And as you can imagine, a furniture factory, what do they have? They have wood, they have sawdust.
The building was over 100 feet tall and 15,000 square feet in total, the equivalent to a quarter of a pro football field, all ablaze.
So then you got embers, you know, size of softballs that are raining on the roofs of structures all around there.
Those structures included lots of industry, as well as wood-framed residential homes in an incredibly dense neighborhood. Residents, in a panic, start rushing to alert their neighbors.
Hey, the building down the street is on fire. As they realized that the fire was spreading, the neighbors basically, what they did was, they would take their possessions and they would move them out of the house into the street because they anticipated that their house would burn down, knowing that how close they were to all these large buildings that were burning.
Rohde says everything back then for the fire department is horse-drawn. Even hooking up to a hydrant is a challenge. And the men had no breathing apparatus.
They would get to the seat of fire, and if they had enough to knock the fire down, they'd knock the fire down, and then they'd come out crawling. They'd be puking their guts out because they breathed all that stuff in. Then the next three on the engine company would go in and do the mop-up.
At 7:20 p.m., an hour and a half after the start of the fire, the blaze was spreading all over the third. The Sentinel wrote, "It seemed as if a mountain of fire rolled across Broadway."
So then the all call went out, so you had resources come from Chicago and Oshkosh, Racine, Kenosha, Sheboygan.
Those departments wouldn't get to Milwaukee for hours since they had to travel by rail. In the meantime, things are getting worse. So bad that the department turned to an aggressive firefighting tactic that they never used, dynamite. The department put 3 kegs of dynamite in a plant on Chicago Street, hoping to create a fire break. The dynamite went off, but the fire continued.
As these buildings are burning, a lot of them are free burning because you only have so many hose lines that you can use to try to put the fire out. They're free burning, the buildings start to collapse.
Around 10 p.m., Kenosha's engine rolls into cheers from onlookers. It's estimated that 200,000 spectators filled the streets to watch the destruction. It was said that if you were a Milwaukeean and you weren't there that night, you were either disabled, an infant, or in jail.
By about midnight, you're about 7 hours into this firefight, and these firefighters are just dog tired because they've been going nonstop and back
dragging hose and trying to play chess.
Rohde says the natural boundaries of the third were an advantage. It was essentially contained from the river to the west to the lake from the east. But the wind is still whipping. If it starts to push north, then the city's young downtown, including City Hall and the courthouse, is all vulnerable. And if the wind pushes to the west,
it was going towards like Plankinton and St. Paul area. And along that river there, they had several large warehouses that were like 1,000 feet long.
Unlimited fuel with no natural breaking points.
And just by the grace of God and just by the sheer wit of the fire department and the members, they were able to get the fire knocked down early the next morning, about 4 or 5 in the morning. But by that time, as you can imagine, 20 square blocks had burned out.
Pictures of the aftermath of the fire resemble warlike destruction. People who had lived in the neighborhood for 50 years couldn't identify where on the block their homes once stood. The third was gone, including the heart of Milwaukee's Irish community.
Population just dried up.
Carl Bayer is a historian and author of From the Emerald Isle to the Cream City, A History of the Irish in Milwaukee. The fire took 5 lives, including 2 firefighters, which seems remarkable considering it leveled over 440 buildings, left 2,500 people homeless, and caused an estimated $5 million in damage. The city rallied around the people who had lost their businesses and homes, setting up committees to assist with housing, work, and other benefits. It was a sort of citywide mutual aid that some point to the roots of Milwaukee's socialist future of entrusting local government. But not everyone found assistance.
There were still advertisements in the paper for jobs and said no Irish need apply. And there was just a lot of bigotry.
Some real estate developers saw this tragedy as an opportunity. All that land, ripe for industry, with direct access to rail and water, and now without the lowest class of people residing there.
There was, of course, the river and the lake, shipping. The real estate people definitely wanted to make that a business center, a warehouse center, a transportation center, and they didn't want those low-class people stopping it.
The Irish eventually resettled to other Irish stronghold neighborhoods like Merrill Park and Torrey Hill, where they had roots. But decades later, Torrey Hill was also destroyed, this time for the Market Interchange.
Except for Merrill Park, there really was no Irish neighborhood after that. They had just dissipated.
The Third Ward Fire of 1892 forever changed Milwaukee. It pushed the fire department to expand and modernize, planting the seeds for the department's first prevention bureau. It brought forth new building codes, which both made the neighborhood safer and more expensive. It displaced the Irish community and soon became a landing place for new immigrants, this time Italian. The neighborhood completely dried up once again before gentrifying in the 70s and 80s. Here's question asker Renee Kubisch and her husband, T.J. Morley.
In the field of architecture, we're often seeing renaissance of ideas that may have been 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago. You know, we see things go in cycles. And I feel that the same has happened here in the Third Ward, that there was housing, there was a community that was identifiable as Irish and had a certain history to itself, unto itself. And I've always been interested in just this geographic zone, the Third Ward, and how it's been able to keep that, but how it's changed over time based on influences of something catastrophic or something financial or something social. And that's just, it's just fascinating. It's a neat story.
What I found really fascinating was the original Irish community and just sort of, you know, you, as you had mentioned, how they were created new communities elsewhere in the city. And one of those communities was basically bulldozed for the freeways. And yet the Irish community in the city still endures. It's still recognizable. It has a presence in a big way.
Milwaukee's Great Fire doesn't just tell the story of that night. It's the story of many past lives that each neighborhood has endured and the way people have built off of tragedy. The Irish did it. The fire department did it too. And so did the rest of Milwaukee.
What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
That was WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez reporting. While this season of Bulber Talk is over, there will be others to come. So if you're wondering about something or something caught your attention, you can submit your question at any time at WUWM.com, and maybe you'll hear it next season. We'll take one more break and then return with a group chat that talks about the power of film festivals from the perspective of a legendary filmmaker and the leader of Milwaukee Film. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Each month, we bring together community members and hand the microphone over to them to lead a segment we call Group Chat. Today features two Susans of film, Susan Kearns, executive director of Milwaukee Film, and legendary filmmaker Susan Seidelman. Seidelman's work includes directing films like Smithereens, the pilot of Sex and the City, and celebrating its 40th anniversary this year, Desperately Seeking Susan. Seidelman will be in Milwaukee this weekend to celebrate the film, her new book, and have a Q&A after the screening. Before that, we brought the Susans together to talk about everything from being the first to cast Madonna to the power of film festivals.
Hi, I'm Susan Kearns. I'm the executive director of Milwaukee Film. We're getting ready to start the Milwaukee Film Festival April 24th through May 8th. And I'm here with iconic director Susan Seidelman to talk about her visit to Milwaukee for the 40th anniversary screening of Desperately Seeking Susan on Saturday, April 26th.
Thank you, and I'm happy to be here, and congratulations on your new job, because the last time we spoke, you didn't have this job.
Yeah.
So that's kind of exciting and a big change for you.
It has been. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's been really great, actually, being able to be immersed again in the film festival world. So, and to be able to highlight differently all the great work I see about, you know, coming out of filmmakers around the world. So to start this chat, I want to ask you a couple of questions about Desperately Seeking Susan, if you don't mind. It's such an iconic film, and I think a lot of people think about the 80s in a very specific way in terms of, like, the colors and the fashion and all of that. And it seems like so much of that stems from this film and this moment that you captured in New York on screen. Can you talk a little bit about your creative process for, you know, thinking about how the film looked, but also how you came to cast Madonna?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because when you make a film, you never think about it that it's going to be a time capsule of a certain period. You know, I like to observe what's going on around me. So I was living in downtown New York and very much a part of that world. And so I was just telling a story about that world as I saw it in that time. And of course, you know, when you talk about the early 80s, we were coming out of a very gritty, the 1970s were very gritty in America, but particularly in New York, because there was a bankruptcy crisis. So suddenly things started to ease up. And I think everyone was, the world was getting a little bit more colorful. And I wanted to kind of capture that. And, you know, I had made a low-budget independent film before this one, a film called Smithereens, that was very much about the downtown kind of punk rock scene. And as a result of that, I got to meet various musicians and just people who hung out downtown. And one of them, and I didn't know her very well at the time, but I knew of her, was Madonna. So when Desperately Seeking Susan came around, you know, it's the story about two very different kinds of women and how their lives impact one another. Rosanna Arquette was attached to the project from the beginning. I started to think about who might play opposite her in an interesting but also an authentic way. And that led me to Madonna, since I had seen some of her early videos, like Borderline. And she seemed to really, well, she seemed to know how to flirt with the camera. The camera liked her. And I thought that would be a good quality to give to the character of Susan.
It's interesting thinking back. I was trying to kind of dig into my own memories of the film, and I do remember like reading about the film in anticipation and seeing like set photos of all of the security and everything as Madonna was like coming to set or leaving set, people like clamoring to get a just like a look at her.
Yeah, only at the end of when we were filming, because when we started filming and when in pre-production, she was still relatively unknown. Just a crazy, somewhat fortuitous thing that happened was that her Like a Virgin album came out during the 9 weeks we were filming. And suddenly she went from relative, she was kind of known, but mostly in New York, to being one of the most famous people in pop culture at that time. And it happened very quickly, very quickly.
So can we talk a little bit about film festivals? Moving back to Smithereens, first American independent film to compete for the Palme d'Or at Cannes. Congratulations, an amazing accomplishment. And it kind of launched your career.
Well, film festivals are really important. That's why it's wonderful that you are now running this one, because it really has so many people, especially, film students and indie filmmakers have launched their careers due to film festivals, whether it's short film festivals where you just get that first audience that recognizes what you're trying to do and you get to test out whether, often as a filmmaker or a film student, you're working in isolation or you're showing it to a couple of your friends, but you never know how it's going to play to an outside audience. Also where you get to talk about films with other people who love watching movies on a big screen in a big dark room.
Yeah. I keep thinking about, when I see a film at the Oriental Theater, which I'm so excited for you to get to experience, I'll be in there with 300 to 1,000 other people, and just the vibe of like the energy of people reacting to the film, it's entirely different than when I'm watching something at home, streaming online.
Which is why I think film festivals are so important, particularly nowadays, when most young people are growing up just watching, entire movies on their iPhone.
Yeah. I've been talking to people recently, too, about they've been kind of confessing that movie theaters were one of the first places they were allowed to go alone as a kid. And so there's a way in which you feel like a little bit more adult or a little bit more freedom or whatever in that space.
Yeah. I remember when I was a kid, that's why I got kind of hooked on movies. My mother would take my sister and I to a movie theater that was down the street from the hair salon where she would go to get her hair done. and we would watch, and back then you saw a double feature. Usually they were two horror films, but it was a grown-up experience and we got to eat all the junk food we wanted to eat.
Yeah.
Yes, for a lot of people, those memories are so much a part of their childhood.
Yeah. We had the similar in downtown Cedar Falls, Iowa, we had the Region Theater, and on Saturday afternoon, they would show just like whatever kids film, and it was like hundreds of kids in there I feel so bad for the people who were working at that theater, like the mess that they probably had to clean up. But, we would all like stomp our feet when the movie was beginning, and just that vibe, I think, really did hook me into the whole thing. So thinking about all of the films that you've made, the television shows over the years, obviously you've delved into women's lives in so many nuanced ways. Are there any contemporary stories about women that you feel like aren't being told right now that you'd really like to see?
I'll be honest. I mean, I'd like to make another film, but I also believe in passing the baton on. And so I'm kind of excited about the stuff that younger generations, women today, not just women, outsiders, of various sorts, are now getting the opportunity to tell their stories. I'm glad I got a chance to tell mine. I still have some more stories to tell, but I'm fascinated by what it sounds like you're doing at your festival, trying to bring in all kinds of voices. Some of that's happening, I guess, using streaming and all the new platforms. But the studio system is still pretty old fashioned, mm-hmm. still pretty conservative. You know, I mean, the statistics are,
yeah.
I think in terms of studio, maybe only last year, 15% were directed by women. And I don't know what the percentage was for people of color or the LGBTQ community. I'm not sure, but I'm sure it's pretty low.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things you're reminding me of, too, is the importance of short films. And I think that's one of the things that I'm glad that we can highlight at the Milwaukee Film Festival, because somebody asked me recently, you know, well, what are the films that I should see to, like, be watching the stories that I haven't seen before? And I started to really think about it. And I was like, I think pointing people to short films, because that's where new voices are able to get their start before they can get the funding for a full-length feature. They can try some things out in, you know, 5 minutes or 15 minutes or whatever it is. And for as much as YouTube is, you know, a massive phenomenon, and I watch a lot of things on YouTube, I think film festivals are really still the one place where you can get sort of a curated shorts experience.
Absolutely. I'm curious because I know you made a film recently, a multi-camera film, correct?
we're still working on it. Yeah. But this job has kind of interfered with my own filmmaking. But we're pitching it as like a strange shot on 16mm horror film. And slowly, in bits and pieces, it's coming together. But it's been a lot of fun to make.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, coming from the world of academia and also being a festival programmer, how that relates to actually making a film, which is a very collaborative experience. I mean, the director is the leader of that collaboration and has to keep everyone's vision honed.
Yeah.
But how you navigate that water.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure I figured it out yet, but I'm trying to kind of keep the project sort of slowly moving forward. When you're working on an independent film, it's like the projects kind of take their own, they work at their own pace a lot of times. So I do think that being a maker gives me a different, I just have so much admiration for, like, every film that gets done. My partner, Jay, has often said, you know, it doesn't take any less work to make a bad film. And it's true, you know, because it's just so much work and so many voices, like you were saying, like so many creative voices coming together to get something done that in some ways, when I'm thinking about programming, it's probably bad because I'm very generous and I'm like, oh, but they were really trying their best, you know?
Yeah. That's kind of the key to filmmaking, I think, and that's tenacity.
Yeah.
So many things that can go wrong that do go wrong. There's so many reasons to stop making the film.
Absolutely, yeah.
And what I found is you need a strong vision because it is collaborative and there's so many ways you can get sidetracked. So the director, along with the producers and, you know, really needs to kind of keep the train on the track and remember why you're making the movie. And that idea of, you know, how you navigate so many egos, you know, everyone has a great creative idea, you know, how you kind of diplomatically encourage people to be creative, but stay in line with this overall vision. So you're all making the same movie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I remember talking to a group of students one time and they were talking about collaboration. I was like, okay, imagine that you're writing a poem with like 50 people and they're just like, oh, that sounds awful. I was like, well, that's what you're doing, you know?
Yeah. So, but
it is, you have to, I think it's also about really valuing and honoring your collaborators and trusting that the things they're bringing to the process are, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Susan Kearns is the executive director of Milwaukee Film, and Susan Seidelman is a filmmaker. Seidelman and Kearns will be together at the Oriental Theater on April 26th in honor of the 40th anniversary of Desperately Seeking Susan. You can find more information about the screening at wuwm.com. This group chat was produced by myself and WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. Milwaukee Film is a financial supporter of WUWM. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Mayan Silver and Jimmy Gutierrez from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon when we'll look at the impact of more proposed cuts by the Trump administration, now targeting AmeriCorps and the Public Allies Program, which works to develop young leaders and promotes an equitable society. Plus, in our Books and Beyond series, we'll explore the Audio and Braille Literacy Enhancement Program and learn how it provides alternative ways for community members with print disabilities to read. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.